time check for you. 7:13 and a half is our time here on Sky 99.5 FM. And it's time for us to get onto some news making here on the Breakfast Roundtable. And the spotlight is on corruption here in Trinidad and Tobago. If you remember, back on Friday, we linked up with our friends at the MAD company, and they were part of a special event put on by the Trinidad and Tobago Transparency Institute looking at the issue of corruption. The theme of that event actually was how does corruption impact you? It stops with me. Exclamation point. It was all part of their observance of United Nations Anti-Corruption Day for 2017. And it included a panel discussion, and one of the lead panelists having that discussion about corruption and fighting corruption is none other than anti-corruption activist Afra Raymond, who also is managing director of Raymond and Peer Limited and a former president of the Joint Consultative Council. And when he was head of that organization, they were definitely into corruption busting. Good morning to you, Afra Raymond.
Jesse, you make me laugh with that last one, man.
Well, I remember.
Your use of the past tense and the present tense is like a grammar lesson up here this morning, man. Good morning.
You know, the JCC was very vocal about corruption and cleaning things up when you were there.
Yeah, the operative word, was, Go on.
Yeah. Okay.
What?
Now, please,
Are you sure it's not about them?
No, it's not. It's
Let's
about
do that, young people.
Yeah. It's actually about all of us, because all of us in some way, we are tempted by corruption. Our ethics are tested. Mm-hmm. You know, we all like to think that we're good people, but sometimes we do things that are a little shady, and we don't even realize that we are being shady. And that's why this this tagline was so important this year. It stops with me. Let's talk about that a bit. Go ahead.
Well, I think that the main thing about it is that the corrupt behavior, which is part of the society, actually puts the social contract in jeopardy. So the social contract is one in which you behave a certain way and you conform to certain rules and you receive certain benefits and privileges and a way forward. And in fact, there's a written contract, and then there's another contract, which is what is really, really going on. And what we have happening is that we have, in our country, one of the highest rates, I think, on the planet, probably in the top 10, of graduates, university graduates who migrate. And there has to be a reason for that. That is part of the kind of unfolding tragedy of the post-independence era. Why is that? Why is it that so many of our young people, I forget the exact figure, maybe 79 or 81% is a huge number, who get their degrees and go to live somewhere else. And a part of it, in my opinion, is that the opportunities would be limited. Not by who you know, but as we say in Trinidad and Tobago, who know you and what you are prepared to do to advance yourself. It's not a simple black and white question. That is not to say that those of us who have remained or those of us who are in the country listening to me this morning, good morning listeners, are people who are participating actively in these corrupt acts. But in fact, a significant amount, the majority of our young graduates have made this decision. And as a matter of conscience, we have to ask ourselves, why is that? And what can we do to create the opportunity for them to stay here and live here? So it has a direct impact on young people. It's not all about the grand corruption that I normally write about, or JCC or Transparency would take on those huge issues, commissions of inquiry and so on. But those few huge issues percolate down, where in fact a professional culture develops, or as I have been saying, does not develop because of the practices that are entrenched. There's an accepted way of doing things. And if you are a young person and you want to do things in the right way, it can be very challenging. And there are some of us here, I'm going to be careful to repeat that there are some of us here and a significant number of us here who continue to try to do the right thing. So I was happy to be part of Transparency's event on Friday the 8th at UWE. And I continue to be happy to be part of events like that. That point a different way in terms of how we can develop the society and challenge the things that are wrong.
Practices which are entrenched, because I'm looking here at a former chairman of one of the state enterprises, the educational facilities company and so on, and he uses words such as corruption, contamination, bid rigging, intrigue, interference, clandestine functionaries within and without the state enterprise. Would you say this is endemic in most of the state enterprises in Trinidad and Tobago?
That is a widespread. What Mr. Piggott is describing there is widespread. And I'm relieved that he's chosen to come out of his reticent mode and appear at the Joint Select Committee, because I was very concerned when Mr. Piggott resigned rather suddenly. When the Joint Select Committee announced it was going to be examining EFCL, I was quite concerned that it could be that this could be seen as an attempt to avoid testimony. In fact, I think he wrote a letter, if I'm not mistaken. He wrote a letter about 3 weeks ago explaining why he wasn't going. So it is veering very close to a type of disdain that is poisonous to the public cloth.
But what we
hold on a second, Jesse. But having said that, Mr. Piggott has testified. So I would like to thank him for that, because that is important, you know, because everybody goes through progress in life. You start off with one thing and you thought another thing, and then you get to another point. Mr. Piggott has testified. He has given his testimony. It's widely reported in today's newspaper. I haven't read it yet. But it is sure to be revealing things that we need to know about to push forward. You know, I found one of the headlines of the news day to be a little it made me chuckle. I think the headline of the news day was something like Piggott said that corruption made me quit, and I sort of chuckled when I read it, because some of these
essentially this is what he said.
What I was going to say is that having said that, though, you know, saying that he wasn't going to appear, he changed his mind, and one of the first things he said was that I decided to come and do this because my good name and my reputation were at risk. So he decided to clear the air to make sure that people didn't misunderstand his reluctance initially.
Yeah, but Mr. Raymond, you know, I listened to you on Friday, and I was, you know, glad that I was invited, and I did make the attempt to be there.
Yeah.
And it was very stimulating, some of the facts that you brought out.
Yeah.
My concern, and I think I'd ask you a question to that effect. What, you know, we're hearing all of these exposé, all right? Modus operandi, as it were, where it comes to Trinidad and Tobago. Yeah. These are things are not new. We've been here, I mean, since I were in Diapa, I think I'm hearing this. Since probably before Adam was born, this is going on in Trinidad. My concern is, and I think I'd ask you that question, how do we mobilize the mass majority of people who are trying their best to do the right thing, avoid these kinds of environments? How can we mobilize us? Because you talk about change on Friday. We have to be the game changers. We just spoke to Mr. Duke. He talked about certain things. Yesterday, we were speaking to an attorney, Mr. George, and the sentiments have been expressed by I want to think, right-thinking people. And everybody is realizing we need to make a change. But how do we make the change? How do we start this? We're having the conversation, but how do we get this wall or this wheel in motion?
Okay, well, let me just speak to that in a focused manner, as I did Friday. This is a vast and powerful set of interests, the interests that are benefiting from these acts of grand corruption. And they're not going to be toppled or stopped by well-wishers or do-gooders, to put it in a simple kind of language. We have worked very hard, and by we, I mean my colleagues, my erstwhile colleagues at JCC, colleagues at Transparency, the Manufacturers Association, the Chambers of Commerce, the trade union movement, Phyton was involved. We have worked for years to produce a new law that will tackle and greatly reduce corruption in the transactions in public money. And that law is the Public Procurement and Disposal of Public Property Act. That law has now been passed into the laws of Trinidad and Tobago, and it's not yet been fully implemented. So we need to understand two or three points. I'm going to make 3 points before I take a break. Point number one is that although we wrote the law, and the government, at the time it was Mrs. Kamla Prasad Bisesa, where Dr. Tiwari was in the leadership of that exercise, they made amendments, and Mr. Imbert and Dr. Rowley and those people made further amendments when they came into office 2 years ago or so. The law that is currently on our books is a very, very good law. It contains about 85 or 90% of what we wanted. So that's the first thing. The law that is there, that is about to be implemented, is very, very good. It is very, very strong. It is what we need. Second point is that there's been a lot of misguided commentary that the People's Partnership didn't implement it, and now there's a commentary that the Rowley administration is not implementing it. And we need to understand that the implementation of the law, the appointment of the board that runs the organization is called the Office of Procurement Regulation. That board appointment is in the hands of the president. The president of the country has to consult with the prime minister and the leader of the opposition. So the second point is that that series of critical appointments is in the hands of the president as President Kamona. And the third point I want to close on is today is the 12th of December. President Kamona and Mr. Imbert both made separate press releases on the 2nd of November. Those press releases, to cut through the chase, both of them promised that at the end of December, the operation would start, the whole operation of the new procurement system would start. Therefore, we have just about 2 weeks. And we have to be focused and try to see what is happening in that 2 weeks, because this is a critical decision. This is my third point. It is no point having a beautifully written law, a powerful law, if the people in charge of operating the law are people who cannot tell right from wrong. Therefore, we need to be assured, and I am speaking for myself here, I'm no longer chairman of any organization, we need to be assured that the necessary steps have been taken to give us the best possible chance to come out of this mess, which is the question you asked me. Okay? And I could get into the next round about what is it I'm asking for.
So if the president doesn't act, if the AG doesn't act, is there some sort of short-circuiting of the process?
It doesn't act in what sense? I'm not getting you, Edison.
But you said that the AG must act and the president must make certain appointments and that kind of thing.
The president, I didn't mention the AG. The president has to make the appointments after consultation with the prime minister.
But if these appointments are not made?
Well, there's nothing you can do to press him. But he himself has made a press release. The point I was making in my last reply, he himself has made a press release. This is the office of the president, Kamona, on the 2nd of November. An extensive press release, which concludes by saying that the process is in train and we expect to have all the appointments made by the end of December. So I'm placing reliance on that statement and a statement of the same day coming out of Mr. Imbert's office, in which Mr. Imbert also says, from everything he knows, he expects it to be made by the end of December.
So if they are not made, this is what I'm wondering, is there any matching in the deadline at all?
No, there's nothing to do. There's nothing you can do, because the way our constitution is constructed, the president, in respect of certain actions, and those are actions that fall within presidential discretion, the president cannot be challenged in the courts. There are other places he could be challenged, in the court of public opinion and on the streets, mm-hmm. and people could protest and so on. But in terms of a courtroom reply, the answer is no. There isn't a courtroom instrument you could use to force him to do this or that, or not to do this or that, where it's a presidential discretion. The constitution cloaks him from that kind of challenge.
Now, you were armed with a document that you presented from Jamaica.
Yes, I did, yeah.
Outlining all the contracts, mm-hmm. Yes. That was awarded by the government.
Yes.
Could you elaborate on that a little bit to bring
sure,
a little clarity
sure.
to?
The document I had Friday evening was the report of the Contractor General of Jamaica from some previous year. It would have been 2013 or 2014. And that report contained within two covers the details of all the contracts awarded by the state in Jamaica. The contracts in which there had been complaints, contracts in which there had been overspending, contracts in which things had run out of time, they'd run over time and so on. It was very detailed. It also contains the same information that's in the report in a CD in the back cover. And the whole thing is searchable online. If you go to the Contractor General's website in Jamaica, it's online. And what's important about that example, because the people here who have been opposed to the public procurement and disposal of public property law have always spoken in fearsome terms about the Jamaican Contractor General, and the Contractor General has too much power, and the Contractor General could close down this and stop that and so on and so on. What is interesting is 2 points. Number one is that in Jamaica, where there are people just like us coming out of a colonial experience, Caribbean people, English-speaking Commonwealth country, Jamaica actually put that law in place in 86. Secondly is that in fact, the Contractor General's office, the Contractor General's report that I showed at the meeting and so on, and I was just referring to, what we have put in place in Trinidad and Tobago, but has yet to be implemented, is more powerful than that. Because the situation in Trinidad and Tobago is very, very serious. That is why these reports give you little glimpses of what It's a very serious situation. Therefore, there needs to be a very solid set of laws to deal with those challenges.
Afa Raymond, I'm a little confused, though. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't one want someone who is that powerful, who when they find something can shut it down, or if not shut it down, at least put it on ice for a little while,
yes,
while they're doing their investigations, yes, because it will defeat the entire purpose of any investigation if while they're supposed to be doing their checks, you're continuing business as usual.
Absolutely.
And have the opportunity to destroy evidence.
Absolutely.
Yes?
So the point you're making is that you need to have somebody doing that job, just in terms of the office holder, who has the necessary powers to shut down a contract that is deemed to be improper or suspicious, and or to sequester certain documents and records before those are destroyed and so on. The two things I want to say to you is that we are in a situation where in the electronic age, as the people in the Panama Papers discovered, nothing is ever really destroyed. Let's just come out of the 1950s thinking. Mm-hmm. So shredding a file or throwing up a bundle of papers in the Gulf of Paria, that is old-fashioned stuff from the old-fashioned movies. The people who invested in the Panama Papers are an important learning for us. Eh? The people who invested in those Panama situations, those accounts and all of that stuff to hide money, big drug barons, big money launderers, all kinds of criminals and so on, politicians who were taking bribes, FIFA people, all those sorts of people, we read about them. All of those people thought, well, my business fix, because my so-and-so partner, my second cousin, is a lawyer in this firm, and he's handling for me down in Panama. And it was like something safe, like long time. You talk about a Swiss bank account.
Yes.
Is it safe?
Not
because
anymore.
Somebody in the bank, in the law firm, Moseca Fonseca, somebody in that firm, or somebody is in the firm, or somebody in the IT department, or somebody even in the company handling the server, didn't like what they were seeing and touched two or three buttons. How safe is it? And those are some of the most powerful people on the planet who thought their business under wraps. So I'm not saying that it's a matter of no concern. I'm just trying to place it in today's context in terms of how records are kept today. And of course, we have to have a look at what is admissible in our courts in terms of electronic evidence and so on. But the notion of something being completely destroyed is old hat.
Mm-hmm. As you make that point about you know, what's admissible in court, just a couple points. Some of the people, one or two of the people I know recently, one of the journalists involved in that Panama Papers expose was assassinated. That's one.
Mm-hmm.
Two, what's admissible in our courts? We're still having difficulty with finalizing whistleblower legislation. In terms of electronic documents being admissible in court, in terms of videotaped testimony of someone who may have been killed, a whistleblower who may have been killed before the case could actually be brought into court. All of those are considerations that are connected to all of this procurement legislation.
Yes.
Real considerations.
Sure.
Because the people blowing the whistle can die.
Yes.
Yeah?
Let me just make a point, if I may, to conclude the question about what we can do. Because Dr. Hayward asked a very important point a little while ago about what we can do. And I gave three points. The first one being that our law is very powerful. The second one being that the president has the power to make the appointment. And the third one being that we have a limited time, 2 weeks, in which all of this is going to go down. And I want to say that there are three things that I would like to see in order to establish a degree of transparency and a degree of comfort around these appointments. The first thing would be, I'd like to be told, and this is a call I'm making to the office of the president. This is nothing to do with Rowley and Kamala and those politicians. I'm saying I'd like to know what is the process that was being followed between the application that was made and the shortlist. Secondly, I'd like to know who was administering that process. Was it a firm that was hired? Was it five or six professional people he had confidence in? Who was actually administering the process? The names of those persons or the firm. And thirdly, who is on the shortlist? What are the points? What were the marks? So Hayward got 102, you got 122. I'd like to know that. I don't want to get up on Boxing Morning and have a surprise that the new procurement board is these 11 people and we didn't have any input all the way through. I think a degree of comfort and assurance could be achieved by sharing that information with the public at this stage before the appointments are made.
Mm-hmm.
That's the call I'm making.
So the consultation means what? I mean, you've heard of consultation. Mm-hmm. Does it necessarily mean that I have talks with a particular individual and so on? Or could I say, well, I'm appointing so-and-so, but it's a fait accompli.
Yeah, well,
what does consultation mean?
It's a big question you're asking. It's a small word with a big meaning. I think that what has happened in the past in situations like this, and what may well happen in this situation, I expect that if President Kamona comes to a decision after this process we just discussed briefly, when he comes to a decision about 9 people or 11 people he's going to appoint, he would write a letter to the 2 parties he's required to consult with, which is Dr. Rowley, the Prime Minister, and Mrs. Kamla Prasad Bisesa, the leader of the opposition, and say to them, having gone through a process, I have decided I'm minded to make these appointments.
I am minded.
Oh yeah, I'm minded. Or I'm considering
making
these appointments.
Does that necessarily mean that these I have made up my mind?
It could be. But it's really going to be a question that he wants to have on the record as far as how consultation is operated in our sphere at the moment. He wants to have on the record that you were told, not necessarily that you were asked.
But that really is no consultation as such.
Well, you have the opportunity according to the timing of the thing, and there have been some really wretched examples of odd timing in the past in our country. You have the opportunity to write back straight away and say, well, in fact, I have an objection to this person. But of course, an objection in a situation like that would have to be rooted in something. It couldn't just be because of somebody's name or you don't like the person. It has to be rooted in some kind of an example, you know. But it's better for us to have the information than not to have the information. That's my call I'm making at this point.
Now, going forward, that is the way forward, Mr. Raymond.
Yes.
But how do we treat with all, like, this corruption, collusion rampant here, according to Mr. Piggott, and how do we treat with what's on the plate already? We hear the sentiments coming from the AG. All right, they want to investigate this. They need an anti-crime bill because a lot of accounts have probably millions and billions, and God alone knows.
Yes.
And they want to be able to trace that to show how do we, going forward, we're talking about the Procurement Act and so on and implementing that. But how does that affect what is going on now in the public domain?
I don't think that what is happening now would be affected by the procurement law, because the procurement law, when it comes into force, it will have 2 effects. The existing arrangements, which is the Central Tenders Board, the existing overarching arrangement for government contracting for goods, works and services, will be extinguished. Okay? The other thing is that the new arrangements would have to come into force with regulations and so on, would have to come into force from a particular date. So all that you are discussing, the current contracts within various state agencies and so on, NITCO, EMBD, EFCL, HDC, all those sorts of things. All those sorts of things that are existing, they're already there. You wouldn't be able to prosecute or look backward. It's not a retrospective law. That wasn't in contemplation.
These revelations that were made by Mr. Arnold Piggott,
yes.
This is, would you describe it as particularly unique? Oh, I mean, I have never heard any CEO or whatever it is of any state enterprise come out so openly and blatantly and say, you know, interference, you know, Balize House doesn't influence what I say and so on. There's hatred, there's misfeasance and so on. I have never heard any leader of any state enterprise making these very clear statements. This is unique in our history.
Well, there have been times like that in the past, eh? But the thing I want to say is that Mr. Piggott's revelations have an echo with me, because going back to 2011, and I think it was June and July of 2011, 6 years ago, I started a campaign, and at that point I declared in writing that EFCL needs to get a commission of inquiry of its own. 6 years on, we haven't had it, and the closest thing we've had is the current hearings of the Joint Select Committee. And having just turned it, cracked the tap, a whole lot of stuff is falling out. But I said that 6 years ago. So the current opposition, who were in office 6 years ago, they have a very good idea what that is about. And what Mr. Piggott is speaking about, let me just say, is not only restricted to the People's Partnership term in office. It also took place subsequent to Dr. Rowley's election in September of 2015. So it's a serious problem that needs to be resolved by people of fortitude, you know, is a serious problem.
This is the Breakfast Roundtable here on Sky 99.5 FM. We're speaking with corruption buster Afra Raymond on the Breakfast Roundtable. We'll continue right after this break.
In your car, on your phone, The sky is everywhere. Sky 99.5 FM.
Allegations of impropriety and government interference in the operations of the EFCL. All this revealed as the former chairman of the company appeared before a joint select committee examining state enterprises.
Now, after turning down numerous requests to appear before the committee, Arnold Pickett told its chairman that the parliament had no authority to summon him. Janelle Bernard has more.
In his testimony, the former chairman of the EFCL says that the education facilities company was contaminated and riddled with political interference.
A substantial amount of influence peddling in the affairs of EFCL was taking place, as well as interference in corporate policies and board decision making.
He says there were interventions on many levels.
There were interventions by the Minister of Finance. A meeting of the board was summoned by the Honorable Attorney General on August 16, 2017, the day after Mr. Frederick was suspended. And there were interventions by the line minister.
Arnold Pickett says there were a number of questionable transactions at the EFCL.
A mill room in which fake invoices were being generated under direct guidance of senior executive. 160 checks drawn in favor of contractors for $33 million to various contractors in a cabinet in the office of the finance division. Records showing in excess of 120 contracts to one contractor for some $40 million, and another with 42 contracts for some $825 million.
The former chairman says an audit conducted determined that there were clear breaches of the tender rules. He says he lost confidence in the procurement process as he believed certain contractors were being given preferential treatment.
Budget sums approved by the MOE, by Ministry of Education, were being leaked to contractors. From inside of EFCL.
GSC Chairman David Small says the information disclosed is disturbing.
What is emerging is a pattern of malfeasance in public office.
And Pickett says some of the people at the center of the alleged controversy are still at the EFCL.
IT manager's laptop was wiped clean when PwC took possession of it.
Janelle Bernard, CNC 3 News.
Meanwhile, we spoke to the Attorney General, Faris Al-Rawi, to answer these allegations. Mr. Al-Rawi told us that an investigation by his ministry has been underway for some time and has been taking place even prior to this JSC examination.
The facts include that a report was made to the Office of the Attorney General concerning impropriety, allegations of impropriety under Chairman Pickett at the EFCL. As a result of this, the representatives of the Office of the Attorney General attended upon the EFCL and obtained documentation. An opinion was rendered by the Office of the Attorney General, which demonstrated the need for further investigative work. The Central Authority Unit of the Ministry of Finance was called upon to go into the EFCL and to conduct an audit. And I can confirm that that field investigative work is now at an end and that the unit is in the process of drawing up its report.
So that's the news report that emerged last night out of Mr. Pickett's appearance before the JSC yesterday. One of the things that crossed my mind as I listened to all of that is that what Mr. Pickett was talking about is not something that was created yesterday or the night before he went there. A system was fully entrenched, a well-working, well-oiled machine existed before he got there. So anything that was observed while he was there probably had absolutely nothing to do with him. And he probably either was not aware or probably did not know how to bring it to an end. It's not that I'm defending him, but I'm just saying that somebody who goes in the middle of something and sees that going on, you know, they're in a sticky wicket. Afra Raymond, your thoughts?
Well, at the end of the day, the chairman of the board of EFCL and the board directors of EFCL are responsible for the things that take place in the company. That is the Companies Act, okay? And you're responsible for directing and superintending the operations of the company, okay? And you're responsible for putting policies and procedures in place to ensure that the company is properly run in compliance with the law and to achieve its mission and its vision and its objectives of the shareholder. So I don't support the notion that someone or a seasoned board, and I know a number of people who are on the board, it's not just Pickett. I know two other friends of mine who are attorneys who are on that board. I don't accept the point of view that board members are in a situation of helplessness, or I don't accept that. You know, there's a situation of responsibility under section, I hope you all are listening. There's a situation of responsibility under Section 99, Subsection 1 of the Companies Act 1995. And as board directors, you all have a legal duty to uphold that standard of responsibility. We've had too few cases where Section 99, Subsection 1 has been litigated for its meaning. We had three cases, and we need to note where we have developments in our country, because everything is not backward. We had three cases, which I'm sure were started for political motivations, by former Attorney General Anand Ram Logan, senior counsel. One case was the Petrotrin case with Malcolm Jones and the gas, the liquids and that sort of thing. Another case was ETEC with Professor Ken Julian. And the third case was UTT with Professor Ken Julian. In my point of view, those lawsuits were launched for what seemed to me to be political motivations to get at two of the big generals that supported the PNM, that was Malcolm Jones and Professor Ken Julian. But the underlying point, and I've checked carefully, I've checked along with senior counsel and top corporate attorneys, as far as I'm aware, that is the first time, those three cases, that Section 99.1 was litigated, that a serious lawsuit was brought against boards of directors who had made certain decisions or not made certain decisions to test were those decisions in conformity with the legal standard. The Petrotrin case was discontinued, as we know, when the current administration took office. Mr. Jones has now passed away. The UTT case was discontinued when the key witness for the state changed his mind on the witness stand. He reversed his testimony. And the ETEC case continues, is very interesting. So the Attorney General's office sued on behalf of ETEC, sued the former board, which was Professor Ken Julian, former Miss Universe Wendy Fitzwilliam and other people like that, for a series of decisions they made around a major investment. And I think the state prevailed in the High Court, the state prevailed in the Appeal Court, and is on the way to the Privy Council. So we've only had one case in 22 years on how that section operates, tested in court. So I don't accept, I'm not accusing the people in the EFCL of having stolen any money or anything, the current board members. I'm just saying that I don't accept your submission, Jesse, that there's some sort of lower level of responsibility because something was going on before. The responsibility of the board is to put procedures and policies in place to make sure the company runs properly. That's so, my position.
So people may want to pull themselves out, but they really can't.
Not
they
as
really
far as I'm
can't,
concerned.
Because they had oversight.
Well, in fact, it's interesting. I agree with that position you just said, Jesse. But it's interesting because I think if I understood what Attorney General Faris Al-Rawi said in your short clip, he actually made the point that there were certain things that took place under the chairmanship of Anand Pickett. So
yes.
Al-Rawi seems to me to have been making a similar sort of assertion.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But this is not the only...
Dr. Wayne, just there's a, yeah, right.
Yeah, okay.
Okay,
thank you.
Better.
Well, let me rephrase the question. Is this the only government institution or organization that these kinds of practices have been taking place under successive administration, or is this an isolated case?
No, they're not isolated. I mean, at the end of the day, what we have here is a sort of a pandemic. They use the language of epidemiology and disease control. Is a pandemic where, in fact, it's widespread through the society. And what's
so
interesting,
there is a proliferation, if you want to say that term,
absolutely,
throughout the whole, all government sectors.
But what's interesting about it is this, because although it's widespread, we need to be careful what it is we're describing. And there's also a tendency, a dangerous tendency, to fall into the all-a-wee-teeth Desmond Carty kind of thing, and that's not what I'm saying. Let's be really careful. As I said on Friday night, if it is we have 2,500 lawyers in the country, and if it is we have 25,000 deeds registered every year, and let us say for the sake of discussion, 500 of them are deeds that are not quite straight, but they may be a little improper, let's say so. Those 500 deeds would have been written by a dozen lawyers. So there are two points coming out of this. Number one, when you see stupidness as a professional, talking as a practicing professional, when you see stupidness, you recognize it at once. You say, this figure doesn't make any sense. This is stupidness. The practitioners who are listening know what I'm talking about. You see it and you recognize it at once, like somebody wearing a big red nose at Christmas. Second point, there are only a small number of people who repeat offenders. They use the language of criminology, recidivists, who just repeat crime over and over and over, like they like jail. There are certain people who just repeat this thing over and over, and there are some lawyers that most of what they do is that kind of deed. Some accountants, most of what they do is that kind of audit. Some engineers, most of what they do is they sign off on that kind of project. Okay? And some surveyors will sign all sorts of figures. And the point is, if we can recognize the nonsense when we see it, and it's only a small number of us doing it, why don't we take care of this problem? And this is what the new Public Procurement and Disposal of Public Property Act is intended to achieve, to put in place a system that covers all of the operations involving public money and gives us the tools and the approaches to deal with it. But it will not happen unless we have the correct people with the correct aptitude and who know right from wrong appointed to the office. You can have the most beautiful law with the most powerful legal provisions. If people don't recognize that something wrong is taking place, or they have the attitude in their breast, but that is my friend, we still have a problem.
Because 160 checks drawn in favor of contractors for $33 million in a cabinet in the Office of the Finance Division. Records showing 120 contracts to one contractor for $40 million and another with 42 contracts for $825 million and so on. But so as a contractor, if you say, I'm going to go the legal way, you know, submit tenders, reply to the tenders and so on, but the whoever is in the office in whatever state enterprise may already have made up their minds as to who's getting the contracts.
Yeah, I mean, we have all kind of phenomena. I'll give another little anecdote. No names in this one. We've been using names so far, Pigott and EFCL and Al Rawi, and we use a few names. Let me give one with no names. So I was speaking last week with a close colleague who's very senior, the second in charge of a big state agency. And he was saying to me, I just came out of a meeting with a contractor who was outraged because he wasn't getting contracts and he felt he wasn't being treated fairly in the tendering process. So he asked for a meeting with me, and he does so much work for us. I had a meeting with him. But before the meeting, I asked my staff to pull a report about what work he's getting. And I was astonished. We had given 18 contracts, large contracts to do particular things. And in the last year, the man had won 15 out of 18 contracts. But he was hell-bent that he had not gotten enough work. And he wanted a meeting with this top man to put the thing right, because what was happening wasn't right. And my colleague just said to me, like the guy wanted 18 out of 18. So we have a lot of attitudes in terms of aspirations and appetite and so that are magnified through these processes that may be fundamentally unfair. So people get contracts by unfair means. Merit has diminished as a form of order to allocate work and to allocate opportunities, and merit needs to come back to the top of the list. And all of this is part of the philosophical advancement and getting out of the thing and making progress. Merit needs to come to the top of the list.
This is a matter of interest. Yes. As you give that example,
yes.
Let's say that this person who got the 15 out of 18, if we were looking at it from a merit-based perspective, let's say that there was no interference of any kind, but by merit, he could have got 18 out of 18 because of his capacity.
Mm-hmm.
Should anything have been done about that? The fact that this one person, because of their capability and capacity, got 18 out of 18, should there be any interference there to spread the thing around more?
Well, there's another aspect to what you're saying, and you're making a very valuable point, Jesse, because yes, it's true that you could have a contractor X whose work is of quality and who truly deserves purely on merit to get 18 out of 18. That's a possibility. It's very, very unlikely. It's kind of out of the edge of the universe. Having said that, what you want to do in a procurement system that is focused around national development and preserving value for money, you want to be able at some kind of level, even if it's 5% or 10% of the contracts, at some kind of level, to have an allowance to allow new people to come to the table. Because you don't want to get into an entrenched situation where you only have two contractors in the country who could build roads, or three contractors who could build a bridge, or four contractors who could build a multi-story building. You would like to have a situation as we go through the years that we actually advance the quality of the human resources in the industry and advance the quality of the participants in the industry by creating opportunities. But you have to have ways to test their performance,
because
which is part of the new system. Yeah.
Because you'd be paving the way for monopolization at worst and cartelization at medium. I don't want to say minimum, at medium.
But you know, Jesse, sometimes you make me wonder whether you were making a joke. You say paving the way for monopolization and at minimum cartelization. Very witty. Paving the way. Yeah.
Now, we focus on the top. on the top. But I want to go now to the bottom, because, you know, this trickles down.
Sure.
Right? We're looking at the top and we're hearing all of this. Mm-hmm. But what about in the government office right down the street?
Yes.
To get a deed. Land with deeds that when you go and you do the tracing, you know, you're finding out that as you said a while ago, Mr. Raymond, this ain't looking right.
Yes.
How do we treat with that? Because you're looking at the top, but we have to treat with those people right across.
Okay.
It used to be in the Red House. I don't know if they're still
it's
there.
It's at the Registrar General's Department on the old Huggins building on right. South Quay. But the point I was making in relation to that, first of all, let me just say that my work has not really been focused on that level of corruption. It's really been grand corruption. Having said that, we have made some progress, and I think we need to also pause now and again in between the lamentation, pause and note when progress has been made. So I would make the point that I attended a ceremony on the 27th of November at the Registrar General's invitation at the Attorney General and office, the new office in Port of Spain here on Richmond Street, at which they launched the second part of a database. They already had, under former Minister of Legal Affairs Peter Taylor, they had already digitized what we call the old deeds. So you'd have deed number XYZ of a particular year. All of those old deeds and plans were digitized back in about, when was it, Manning called election? 2009 or 2010, yeah? And what the current Registrar General has done, that is Ms. Karen Bridgewater, what she has done is put in place with her colleagues a system to digitize the new law, which is the RPO. We have two systems of title in the country. Both of them have now been digitized. So in fact, that greatly increases the transparency, greatly increases the accessibility. I don't think it totally eliminates, nothing can totally eliminate corruption, but it greatly reduces the scope for corruption, and it's a huge step forward. Similarly, I was there when they had the launch on the 27th of November. Similarly, within licensing, a significant number of things have taken place to reduce that kind of nonsense that took place.
And you mentioned licensing. You have the right to do it in the licenses office, because in this report, Mr. Pigger talked about false invoicing.
Yes.
So you have false deeds and you have false license plates.
Yes.
But time, we run out of time. That'll be for another occasion.
It was great.
Yes, sir.
I think we're going to need a second.
On that occasion, I need to have coffee, yeah?
Okay, we'll organize that.
I'm flagging.
Thank you so much, Alfred Raymond, for having breakfast with us
Lovely.
This morning.
Thank you. Metaphorically, yeah.
All the best for the season.
Take care.
Edison Carr, Jesse May Ventur, and Dr. Wayne Haywood on the Breakfast Roundtable on Sky 99.5 FM.